Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.
After an executive order from the Trump administration, Texas becomes the first state to opt out of future refugee resettlement. That story and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. More on Governor Abbott's decision on refugees, which reverses Texas's role as a leader in refugee resettlement. Also, a New York billionaire tours the Lone Star State by bus, trying to make inroads in his presidential campaign. For Michael Bloomberg, the stakes are high. And a disturbing affair in the world of romance novels, plus the biography of a Texan who fought his way out of tough times. All those stories and a whole lot more coming up today on the Texas Standard. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 13th day of January. Happy Monday to you. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Have you ever noticed how some of the biggest stories seem to come on a Friday afternoon? According to the conventional wisdom of the newsroom, this is because politicians like to wait until folks are in a weekend frame of mind, in other words, looking the other direction, when they throw out the bad news, or at least news that could garner negative publicity. But neither of the state's two biggest newspapers, the Dallas Morning News and the Houston Chronicle, missed Governor Greg Abbott's announcement Friday afternoon, and the editorial boards of both papers came out blasting Abbott for that announcement, in case you missed it. Governor Abbott said Texas will opt out of receiving new refugees in fiscal year 2020, under authority of an executive order signed last year by President Trump. This makes Texas the first state in the nation to opt out of receiving new refugees. Diane Solis covers immigration for the Dallas Morning News. She's been following this story. Diane, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
We should make it clear, by the way, that you are not on the editorial board. You are a reporter here, an unbiased reporter. Tell us a little bit about what exactly Governor Abbott was doing here. He was facing a deadline of sorts, right?
He was. And so he became the 43rd governor to make a decision on whether to opt in or opt out of resettling refugees in the state. And he decided to opt out, becoming the first in the nation to do so.
Just to be clear, other Republican governors have said yes, of course.
Yes, that's correct. Several have.
Okay. Now, I want to loop back to why it is that this is happening, because in the past, Texas has been one of the, if not the, top location for the resettlement of refugees in all of the United States, right?
That's correct. Frequently, 8 to 10% of the total flow of refugees have come to Texas.
So why exactly is this happening now? This is a kind of a change of policy, right?
Right. It's one in a chain of immigration restrictions by the Trump administration. And this time it hit those who are classified as refugees. But in making the announcement, Governor Abbott conflated immigrants with refugees and asylum seekers with refugees, and many people do this. And there was pushback on that refugees were different. Refugees have been vetted multiple times and for security reasons, and that they have been vetted to make sure that they qualify as a refugee, that is, that they're fearing death or persecution.
Just to be clear, when you say conflated, he's not confused about what refugees are and what's happening on the southern border. It seemed as if the point that he was making was that Texas has historically taken in more than most other states, and we're already dealing with an issue of immigration on the southern border, which federal lawmakers in Washington, he says, have failed to adequately deal with. In other words, Texas is doing enough when it comes to immigration, and we're already dealing with a situation on our southern frontier. Wasn't that his point?
That was one of his points, yes. And we, of course, have the longest border of any state in the country with Mexico.
So
yes, we would deal with more immigration.
So did he articulate his reasoning any further than that? I mean, what else did he say?
Governor Abbott also mentioned, as have others, that we've had a lot of immigration, increasing immigration at our southern border. And indeed, last fiscal year, 2019, about 850,000 immigrants were apprehended at the U.S. border. And that was a doubling from the fiscal year 2018. Since then, in the first 3 months of this fiscal year, apprehensions have been decreasing back down to pace similar to 2018.
What's been the response from refugee groups and other lawmakers? What have you been hearing?
Great disappointment, of course, and even shock. For those that resettle refugees, this is going to be a big blow. And I'm told by one head of an agency here in Dallas that they probably have until June for this to take effect, and they'll still receive refugees who are in the pipeline now. Frequently, refugees in the pipeline are reuniting with family members already here.
One other point that the governor made in his letter, he said there's nothing stopping a refugee resettled in the U.S. from coming to Texas, right? I mean, there's nothing a state can do to stop a refugee from coming.
As a secondary place, that's true. But if this is your place of first landing, then you are eligible for a lot of help or some help from the key refugee resettlement agencies that have contracts with the State Department. Among them are the International Rescue Committee and Catholic Charities.
Diane Solis is a reporter with the Dallas Morning News, and she continues to track this story. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Diane, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on The Standard.
Okay, thank you.
Much has been made of billionaire and former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's plans to spend a big chunk of his personal fortune on media in hopes of landing the Democratic presidential nomination. But this weekend, Bloomberg was in Texas doing politics the old-fashioned way. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies hit the road.
When Michael Bloomberg's brand new campaign bus, the Get It Done Express, pulled up at his first San Antonio stump speech at Market Square, it was greeted by enthusiastic Bloomberg supporters and a handful of aggressive protesters. With Trump 2020 flags and a billboard-sized Come and Take It banner with an assault rifle icon, the anti-Bloomberg forces were letting the former New York mayor know they strongly disagree with one of his signature issues, guns. When Bloomberg addressed the crowd, he didn't back down and highlighted his track record on reining in guns.
Donald Trump is a president who's in the pocket of the gun lobby. Instead of just complaining, I took on the NRA, and the NRA is now in disarray, and they're having fundraising problems.
Bloomberg said he created and funded a national organization that is pushing for universal background checks.
Nobody wants to take away anybody's guns, just background checks, called Every Town, and it's got 6 million supporters so far.
While Bloomberg was shaking hands in the crowd, one of the pro-Trump protesters, Corey Harris, mixed in and cozied up for a selfie. Wearing his red Keep America Great cap, he snapped his photo. Bloomberg didn't flinch.
There was one guy this morning who didn't want to shake my hand. And I said, okay, thank you, but thank you for coming.
Harris said Bloomberg is wrong on guns, and the recent church shooting in White Settlement, Texas, proved it.
If you look at the church shooting 2 weeks ago, the shooter was stopped in 6 seconds.
Jack Wilson, a trained volunteer church security officer, shot and killed the shotgun shooter after he opened fire and killed two churchgoers. Bloomberg still says only law enforcement officers should be armed.
One guy pulling his gun and shooting, thank God he didn't hit an innocent person. We have police, and if we need more police, we should hire them and train them. But I want people that are trained and run under the authority of the government to provide us with security. I just don't want individuals with their own guns in a crowded theater to start shooting.
There's polling that indicates many suburban voters want some tougher gun laws. And Bloomberg says he's running his campaign based on data on what's needed in America and what works.
During my term in City Hall, life expectancy went up by 3 years in New York City. In this country, in the last 3 years, life expectancy has gone down Now, that's the data. The cause is mainly opioids.
Well, his strategy is a risky one.
Cal Gilson is a political science professor at Southern Methodist University. He points out that Bloomberg, who entered the presidential race late, is essentially ignoring the first four primaries and caucuses and looking to gamble big on Super Tuesday in California and Texas.
He didn't have the time or really the personality or interest to do the kind of retail campaigning that is required in both Iowa and New Hampshire. But he did have the money to spend big on television and other kinds of advertising to try to enter the fray on Super Tuesday and win some of those big states, or at least show very, very well.
Gilson said Bloomberg is looking for voters in Texas who haven't had a champion in a long time.
His entry is into the sort of traditional wing of the Democratic Party, the sort of old Lloyd Benson, Lyndon Johnson, John Conley, moderate to conservative Democrats. He has shown no real strength that I'm aware of among Hispanics and blacks. He'll have to build some.
Bloomberg, who is worth over $40 billion, says he's willing to spin big to win in Texas, and his campaign offices will work to elect Democrats up and down the Texas ballot and will support whoever wins the presidential nomination.
We said that whoever wins, we would keep the major offices open across the country until November 3rd.
Does that include Texas?
Oh, yeah, sure.
And what difference do you think that would make?
Every bit helps.
And Bloomberg says his primary goal is to prevent the re-election of Donald Trump. In San Antonio, David Martin Davies reporting.
Okay, let's find out what Texans are talking about on this Monday. Check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David.
Hello.
A huge amount of reaction on the Texas Standard Facebook page to the story from earlier, Governor Greg Abbott's announcement that Texas will not participate in refugee resettlement, the first state to do so under new veto powers bestowed by the Trump administration. 201, the commenters on our page opposed. Layla Blackshear calls the move disgraceful, embarrassing, and cruel. Tim Bauer-Kemper says refugees are the most vetted and background-checked persons in the world. This has zero to do with security and everything to do with bigotry and anti-immigrant rhetoric. And Brian Jackson says, I just want to let them know that Houston, and I'm sure many other cities in the state, are welcoming, even though the Texas state Republican-led government isn't. My understanding that, yeah, this veto decision didn't really effectively override several Texas cities that had written letters in support of such resettlement. You know, that's just one story we're watching. Other breaking news out there, saw Cory Booker just leaving the Democratic presidential primary. We're watching all this stuff, and we'll be back with more later in the show.
Hey, what's going on in your neck of Texas? Tweet us, won't you, at Texas Standard. We're looking for you. Wells Dunbar will be back in 35 or so with more of your comments.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As you're likely aware by now, Iran vowed revenge on the United States for the drone killing of one of its top generals, and it's not clear whether last week's retaliatory airstrikes in Iraq signal that they're done. In the past, Iran has targeted oil infrastructure and Western shipping in the Persian Gulf. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider wanted to find out just how vulnerable Texas might be.
When President Trump addressed the nation on the potential for conflict with Iran last Wednesday, he said this.
Over the last 3 years, under my leadership, our economy is stronger than ever before, and America has achieved energy independence.
Trump said that's changed America's strategic priorities.
We are independent, and we do not need Middle East oil.
Economist Edward Herz is energy fellow at the University of Houston.
Well, he's incorrect. We are not energy independent. We consume roughly 20 million barrels of crude oil each day. We only produce about 12.5 million barrels of crude oil each day.
Hearst says it is true that much of what the U.S. imports now comes from regions more stable than the Middle East.
Now, 4 million from Canada is very significant. Mexico, Brazil. But the fact is that oil can be diverted by other countries who need it more.
Crude oil is a global market. Take China as an example. America's economic rival now uses roughly 10 million barrels a day more than it produces. It has to import the rest.
The Chinese would be bidding for this crude oil. And they, you know, conceivably could outbid the service station here at Westheimer and Shepherd.
But what about all that crude oil Texas produces in the Permian Basin and in shale formations? Don't those make a difference? Jim Crane is the Wallace S. Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at Rice University's Baker Institute.
A lot of the oil that we produce in Texas is mismatched with the refining capacity that we have here. So we ship some of it overseas, and we import heavier crude because our, you know, refineries on the Gulf Coast are configured for heavy crudes. And that's, you know, that's basically not what you got in Texas.
In fact, Texas exports much of that crude oil to refineries overseas that are geared to process it. Many of the refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast wind up processing imported crude. Saudi Aramco, for example, owns the largest refinery in the U.S., the Motiva refinery at Port Arthur. Much of the 600,000 barrels a day it processes comes from, you guessed it, Saudi Arabia.
Whether or not, you know, the president wants us to be 100% self-sufficient on oil, that's just really not possible, or at least it's not likely, I would say.
But Crane says Trump has a point when he says U.S. oil production, particularly Texas production, has given the U.S. a freer hand in foreign policy. That's again because crude oil is a global market. And right now, that market is flooded. Say Iran decided to attack the oil infrastructure of America's allies in the Persian Gulf, as it's alleged to have done last year in Saudi Arabia.
An attack on oil infrastructure in the Gulf would probably have a short-term effect on the oil price, cause a little bit of pain for drivers, but probably wouldn't have the long-term effect on prices that Iran might be looking for.
That extra Texas production on the world market means we probably won't see anything like the spikes we saw in the early 2000s as a result of the Iraq War.
I suspect any retaliation that Iran takes that hits at the oil market is probably going to have a, you know, slightly beneficial effect to the Houston economy in that it would drive up oil prices and that upstream oil producers in Texas would get a slight, probably very short-term benefit.
The exception, both Crane and the UH's Edward Herz say, would be a direct Iranian attack on U.S. soil. Neither believes Iran is likely to go that far and risk an overwhelming American response. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. It's a headline we've seen before, Texas facing a nursing shortage, but as we start a new decade, some alarming projections from the Texas Department of State Health Services. They're projecting a shortage of nearly 60,000 nurses by this decade's end. Why and what does this mean for the health of Texas's healthcare workforce come 2030? Joining us now to talk about that is Cindy Zolnarek. She is CEO of the Texas Nurses Association. Ms. Zolnarek, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
This isn't something we haven't heard. You know, we've been warned about this, but do you see the nursing shortage getting worse in the coming decade? Is that why the alarm bells are going off now?
There's been a long-standing nursing shortage, and we've made tremendous strides in addressing it. I think what we're seeing right now is the baby boomers, which include nurses, are retiring, which takes nurses out of the workforce. At the same time, the baby boomers are creating an increased demand. So I think that's the alarm over the next decade, is how are we going to care for this increasing population of older adults who will need health care?
So, I mean, what I hear you talking about is this aging population. But what about training for new nurses? Where is that happening, and is it happening at the rate that it needs to?
Well, virtually every community in Texas has opportunities for individuals to pursue nursing education. Universities, community colleges all offer those opportunities.
However, what we're finding that there is an increased demand, and schools are having difficulty keeping up with that demand. In fact, thousands of nurses are turned away from nursing school because they just don't have the capacity.
So it's literally training capacity that seems to be the issue here. What then would be a solution? Are you trying to convince universities or colleges to allocate funds for nursing training? Is this something that you approach lawmakers about? How do you deal with that sort of problem?
Well, a solution is multifaceted, and certainly financing is a big component. And for over 15 years, our legislature has been very supportive in investing in nursing education. And through the Nursing Shortage Reduction Program, they have invested millions of dollars to support schools in increasing their capacity and increasing their graduates in pre-licensure programs. Additionally, the Higher Education Coordinating Board, through tobacco fund grants, have been able to fund innovative approaches so schools can look at how they can increase their capacity by doing things such as simulation, looking at alternative clinical training sites, which often is where there is a block in the throughput of nurses being able to be educated.
Is there an urban-rural divide here?
Well, the rural areas are particularly challenged in attracting nurses. There are many factors for that, but definitely they feel the impact of the shortage to a much greater extent than do the urban communities.
Is Texas alone in dealing with this, or are other states facing similar situations?
Other states do face a similar shortage, I think, but not all states. What is on the national level, what we're seeing is more of a maldistribution of nurses, where you see some areas, like the urban areas, may have plenty of nurse resources, and the rural communities may not. In Texas, we are seeing that shortage throughout the state. So we do stand out in terms of the nursing shortage.
It's a complex problem, one that Cindy Zolnarek is trying to call attention to as CEO of the Texas Nurses Association, which is predicting a shortage of nearly 60,000 nurses by the end of the decade. Ms. Zolnarek, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to tell us about the situation here on the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. In the next hour, Governor Greg Abbott is set to honor a member of the West Freeway Church of Christ. As KERA's Rachel Osier Lindley reports, Jack Wilson helped stop a gunman who attacked the congregation in the Fort Worth area last month.
Wilson, who's head of the church's security team, shot and killed the gunman. The shooter opened fire during Sunday services on December 29th, killing two churchgoers. They were 67-year-old Richard White and 64-year-old Anton Tony Wallace. Governor Abbott says Wilson's actions prevented further loss of life. To honor his heroism and willingness to risk his own life, Abbott is presenting Wilson with the Governor's Medal of Courage. It's the highest award he can give a civilian. The ceremony is being held at the Governor's Mansion. I'm Rachel Osier Lindley in Dallas.
Former Vice President Joe Biden has picked up an endorsement from Texas Congressman Colin Allred for president. The Dallas area Democrat announced his support on Twitter today. He's the latest Texas Democrat to switch to Biden after initially backing former San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro, who ended his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination earlier this month. The former vice president has campaign events planned in Dallas and Houston later this week. Texas lawmakers are holding a series of public hearings on how to redraw the state's political maps in 2021. The House Redistricting Committee met in El Paso late last week. Christina Sanchez is with El Paso Community College. She urged state representatives to form a separate citizen advisory committee, which could review the proposed political boundaries to prevent partisan gerrymandering.
Reliance on the decision makers, with all due respect, to be driven by good faith alone to ensure that district lines are fair and representative of the communities that comprise our states has not worked throughout most of the state.
Lawmakers will hold additional hearings later this month in Plano and Arlington. The former NFL coach who led the Dallas Cowboys to back-to-back Super Bowl wins in 1992 and 1993 is getting inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Jimmy Johnson learned he'll be part of the centennial class on Sunday during the Fox Sports halftime show of the NFC divisional round game between Green Bay and Seattle. The news surprised Johnson, who is a Fox analyst.
The only thing I can think of is all the assistant coaches that have worked for me. All the great players that have played for me, they're the reason I'm here.
Johnson will be the 328th person inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And Texas native Renee Zellweger is nominated for an Academy Award. The University of Texas alumna made it on the shortlist for Best Actress, announced this morning. She could win the Oscar for playing Judy Garland in the biopic Judy. That performance also won her a Critics' Choice Award for Best Actress on Sunday. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Oscar Wilde once wrote that the very essence of romance is uncertainty. If he were alive today, he might also admit that the essence of romance writing is big money. Romance books are billion-dollar business, but right now the world of romance writing is one big steaming mess. In the past month, there's been turmoil over a lack of diversity among writers and the content they produce. What started as a tweet has led to a complicated controversy, and now the resignation of the president of the board of the 9,000-member Romance Writers of America and cancellation of its annual writing competition. So what happened and what happens next? Andrew Dansby is an entertainment writer for the Houston Chronicle. Andrew, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
How did an entertainment writer at the Houston Chronicle wind up covering a story about the Romance Writers of America? I gather that this is a Texas-based group?
It is. They are Houston-based, and my understanding is it goes back to around 1979.
Now, let's get to the controversy here. One of the former board members, who is of Chinese descent, Courtney Milan, apparently made a tweet back in August, a sort of criticism about a decades-old book. Am I on the right track?
You are. Somewhere Lies the Moon was the title of the book. Catherine Lynn Davis is the author, and there was a Chinese-American character in it that Courtney Milan found. She found the presentation objectionable and tweeted about it.
And she said it was, a racist mess?
Yes, with another word between racist and mess that we've been unable to print at the Chronicle, and it resulted in a complaint filed with the RWA.
Apparently, she was upset about its portrayal of a half-Chinese heroine. That was her issue with the book, or her main issue with the book. So she complains to the RWA, and then what happens?
That's a little bit of a mystery still, in that a complaint was filed, and because this organization is somewhat hermetically sealed off, the process, even within its membership, was kind of done under the table. And so ultimately, the short version is that she was censored for this tweet.
Now wait a minute. I want to get this straight. It wasn't Catherine Lynn Davis, the author of the book Somewhere Lies the Moon. She was not the one censored. It was the person who had tweeted the complaint that was censored.
Correct. And I should state, her name is Heidi Bond. Courtney Milan is a pen name. But she was censured by the organization, but then they quickly rescinded that. There's a lot that happened, and it seemed to happen sort of behind closed doors and in a way that some of the writers and members of the RWA found to be, I'm trying to think of the right word, but they found it less than transparent.
So was there some kind of uprising within the ranks of the RWA?
There was, and it happened on Christmas Eve, and I can't speak to the RWA's intentions, if the intention was to do this under the cloak of holiday quiet time. It didn't work. Several board members resigned on Christmas Eve, and that sort of began this crisis that has subsequently become a more substantial problem.
Some of the imprints apparently were protesting too. They didn't want to have anything to do with the RWA. They started distancing themselves from their annual competition, right?
I mean, correct. They hold their RITA awards every year, and it's a little difficult to know what came first, but a couple of publishers pulled out of the convention and awards on January 6th, I believe. And that was later that day, the RWA announced that it would be suspending the RITA awards for 2020.
So you have the resignation of the president of the board. You have others who have left the board. You have the cancellation of its annual writing competition. And the Romance Writers of America is what now?
It is still an organization. They were there was a petition filed for the recall of its president, and that would have taken place over the next month. So he resigned. Damon Swade was the president of the board, and he resigned January 8th. And so that prevented a recall. And at this point, the RWA has to figure out what it would like to do going forward. It's a little bit of a free fall situation where a lot of management and board members are absent now, and it sort of needs to figure out what it wants to be and who it wants to be.
Andrew Dansby is an entertainment writer for the Houston Chronicle. He's been covering this story on the RWA, the Romance Writers of America, based in Houston. Who knew? Andrew, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a good day.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose research has helped bring more than 90 cancer-fighting drugs to the marketplace. Patients can access national clinical trials phases 1-4 in their communities. More at texasoncology.com.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. In the boxing ring, he was known as Big George, but by the time his was a household name, George Foreman would be known for more than just his championship titles. He was also a heavyweight businessman. Foreman's story, which begins in East Texas and runs through Houston's Fifth Ward, is one of fighting one's way out of hardship, that's for sure. Now comes the first biography about the celebrity boxer and pitchman, No Way But to Fight. George Foreman and the Business of Boxing is the title. Andrew R.M. Smith is the author. He's also assistant professor of sport management and history at Nichols College in Dudley, Massachusetts. Professor Smith, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
What was it that got you so interested in George Foreman's story to begin with? I mean, it's not like he's, you know, on the front pages of newspapers that much anymore.
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest problem was that no one had written a book about him. I grew up not during his initial career, but when he was coming back to the ring. And he was a fascinating story to watch on TV and to read about in the headlines. But I realized I didn't really know anything about his first career. I didn't know why his name was on a grill that I was using to cook on in college. I didn't know a lot about George Foreman. So
had a busy day. My lean, mean, fat-reducing grilling machine is great to come home to. It lets you.
A lot of people really fell in with that grill.
Yes, there were millions that took to an indoor grill appliance.
What was it about? I mean, he didn't invent the grill that bore his name, but what was it about his business acumen, and how did that tie to his boxing career?
Foreman knew it was getting to the end of his boxing career and was looking for some other avenues to, invest in, to keep in the public eye. And so this really was kind of a marriage of convenience between a company in Salton Industries looking for a celebrity endorser and a celebrity looking for something he could not just endorse, but literally put his name on.
When you think about how popular George Foreman was there in the 90s, certainly, he had come a long way since, born in East Texas town of Marshall. I guess he really spent most of his childhood, though, in Houston, in the Bloody Fifth, right?
He did. His family moved when he was really still an infant, and so most of his frame of reference is what had been called the Fifth Ward of Houston. He made trips back to Marshall to visit grandparents, through his childhood, and he eventually bought his own ranch and still felt a connection to East Texas, for sure. But yeah, his formative years were in a pretty rough part of a growing city.
And I should say, I know, wince a little bit when I use that reference to Bloody Fifth. That was what it became known as during a certain period of time in Texas history. What was it about that part of Houston that made it such a tough place to grow up in?
Well, you know, you're talking about crowding a lot of people into a small area that was generally underdeveloped. And that's was not new in that part of Houston, and it certainly hasn't been remedied even as we're now into the 2020s. But part of the exodus of people from rural areas within Texas to a city like Houston that was really growing, especially around World War II with a lot of defense contracts and a lot of shipping industry, funneled a lot of folks into specific areas. And of course, Houston was also still in many ways racially segregated, so there weren't many options for African-American people moving from those former sharecropping arrangements into an urban center, and that's precisely what the Foreman family was doing.
The fighters move out for round one.
I think the first time a lot of people were introduced to Foreman was during the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, right? That was sort of his first big break on the international scene?
That's about the first time anyone might have seen him on TV.
This has to be the highlight of George's life as he goes right after the Russian, Ioannis Chipolis.
Well, tell us about that, one of the most iconic images from the 68 Olympics and George Foreman's role there. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah, so waving the flag is an image that has been, you know, sort of ingrained into the public memory of George Foreman. If you think of George Foreman, if you even Google George Foreman, you find either a teenager waving the flag at the Olympics, or maybe you find someone falling down in front of Muhammad Ali in the mid-1970s, or maybe you find an older, balder man in front of a grill in the mid-1990s. So it's one of these sort of three iconic images of George Foreman.
There is George holding up the American flag in the center of the ring before thousands of impressed spectators.
There wasn't necessarily a premeditated demonstration, but after the fight was over, one of the things he felt compelled to do was to wave the flag. Now, he did that for about a heartbeat, and then you also see a teenager who's kind of excited, and he breaks into this little dancing riff on a time-honored tradition of bowing to the four corners of the ring after winning an Olympic gold. So you can see it might not have been the most important thing on his mind, but certainly by the time the newspapers hit the next day, that was the most important image in most Americans' minds.
He went on, of course, as most folks know, to have a winning streak as a professional boxer. He eventually would become a heavyweight champion. Remind us some of the fights that defined his career as a boxer in the late 60s and 70s.
The most important fight for his early professional career, he wasn't a part of. This was Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier's first fight. And not just the intrigue and the money that came with their fight, but the difficulties in them renegotiating for a second fight opened up a space where George Foreman could kind of carve in a role and eventually challenge Joe Frazier for the heavyweight championship. And to the surprise of many, defeated Joe Frazier and became heavyweight champion long before a lot of boxing folks thought that Foreman would really be a viable contender. He defended his title twice before he met Muhammad Ali and eventually lost it.
Muhammad Ali has won by a knockdown,
Boy, that's the rumble in the jungle, right?
Exactly, the rumble in the jungle, to which the Zairean government strongly objected. They sent many press releases to inform tourists that no one would be sleeping in any jungles, that there were at least two Western-style hotels in the Kinshasa area.
So the fight with Muhammad Ali would be the end to his heavyweight boxing title, right?
The first time around, yes.
The first time around. He does make his return, and that was when you became really interested in George Foreman, and he becomes a businessman as well as we move into the 90s. Where is George Foreman now? I mean, and what do you think his enduring legacy will be when as a kind of a pop culture figure in the United States?
Right now, he's still in the Houston area. He's further out of town, and you can kind of see the trajectory of George Foreman, like I'm sure a lot of other folks who were able to make it out of, say, the Fifth Ward. But you talk about the enduring legacy of George Foreman to boxing, and I think there are multiple threads, but he really does help clean up the image of boxing in the mid-1990s. remember in the late 80s, boxing in America got a really huge boost from Mike Tyson, who was a dominant heavyweight figure. But with Mike Tyson's conviction for rape in the early 1990s and sort of the change of his character in the years preceding that, boxing had declined a little bit. And I think George Foreman really helped to bring that sport back into at least the American public eye for a few more years. And sort of show us a different vision of what a boxer could be and also what an athlete could be.
That's the voice of Andrew R.M. Smith. He's the author of No Way But to Fight, George Foreman and the Business of Boxing. Professor Smith, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. It's been a lot of fun to get to say hello to you and to talk about a really interesting figure in American popular culture.
Thank you, David. It was my pleasure.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. At a time when many states have moved toward the decriminalization of marijuana, Texas is holding steady. Marijuana is still illegal in Texas and under federal law. But hemp is not. In 2019, Texas lawmakers passed House Bill 1325, which legalized the production and possession of hemp, marijuana's cousin. Now, to the untrained eye or even the trained nose, you'd be hard-pressed to tell the difference, but a laboratory could, either that and or consumption of circumstantial evidence. Some jurisdictions, like Bexar County, have decided to purchase new testing equipment, but some DAs in Texas have decided it's just not worth prosecuting low-level cases of marijuana possession because lab work's just too expensive. On January 23rd, leaders in the Texas capital city will vote on what they plan to do. Buy that lab equipment or effectively tell police to stop making arrests for low-level possession. Austin City Council member Greg Cassart joins us now. Councilman, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
I'm happy to be here.
Where is this push coming from for a vote on whether or not to obtain testing equipment?
The state of Texas has criminalized marijuana, and technically individual cities can't change that. But essentially, while we wait on the state government to come out of the dark ages and do the right thing, and while we wait on getting to legalization from the state, we need to do everything we can to dedicate our city's resources and police efforts towards serious issues, not on pursuing low-level pot cases.
We've spoken with several experts on this story and who've been following what different jurisdictions are doing. And some have the sense that some prosecutors, some DAs are sort of trying to politically stick it to Republicans in the state legislature, sort of say, look, we're moving on from this, and so we're not going to bother with this. In a sense, is that what Austin City Council is trying to do too, sort of send a message?
No, this is about people. I mean, there is the politics, but this is really about people. I mean, marijuana charges can derail people's lives, people who are in our families. You can lose your eligibility for student financial aid. People have lost their jobs. People could even get deported. And so this is about taking care of people. It's a serious issue. The war on drugs for too long has been a war on everyday Texans, especially on communities of color. And so it's really about changing that.
So it's not really about purchasing lab equipment, if I understand what you're saying. What I hear you saying is that Austin City Council, or at least a majority of council members, they're not really interested in trying to buy lab equipment as Bexar County is doing, for example.
That's right. I mean, I think that it is already a waste of resources to be dedicating our time to be pursuing low-level pot cases. And pursuing those cases oftentimes does more harm than good to a community. Now that we're being asked by the legislature, do you want to add even more resources for more complicated testing in order to do the wrong thing? Why would we do that?
But is Austin City Council willing to step up on something else that has to do with lab work? You know, there's been a major issue when it comes to the poor record of testing evidence gathered after sexual assault and rape. So what about rape kits? When is the lab work going to get done there?
That has been actually an effort that I sponsored upon the very first year that the lab fell apart. We redirected a huge amount of our police resources and told the police department and held the police department accountable to addressing the rate kick backlog issue and invested millions of dollars to fix a problem that had started simmering since the 90s. And it's still not done. I mean, we are still doing that heavy lifting and that kind of work. And it means reprioritizing issues. And it means saying things like low-level marijuana is not going to be a priority, and we need to be focusing on sexual assault. We need to be focused on housing people and addressing issues of mental health. So we're trying to tackle those issues. And if we want to prioritize that sort of thing, we cannot keep on ramping up our budget to buy testing equipment to go after low-level pot cases. I mean, that's just, that doesn't make any sense. So it makes sense to make some change, and I'm looking forward to it.
Greg Kassar is an Austin City Council member. We've been talking about an upcoming vote on the 23rd on what next to do about low-level marijuana possession cases. Council member Kassar, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us.
Thank you very much.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Let's check in once again with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, find out what Texans are talking about. Say, Wells, what are Texans talking about?
Well, believe it or not, folks have opinions on that story we just heard about, how the Austin City Council will consider a measure that could essentially end arrests and fines for possession of personal amounts of pot. Via Twitter, KJ says, I think it's a great idea. Stop wasting the insane amount of resources we spend on policing this. Similarly, on our Facebook page, Randall Munro, he says it's a complete waste of time and resources. He adds that other states are adding hundreds of millions in revenues to their state coffers. Colorado has surpassed the $1 billion mark on theirs. And he notes that they're also seeing things like their rate of opiate addiction and treatment for overdoses declining. And Jennifer Ramos, she picks up on an issue, this sort of discrepancy in testing that the council member was just discussing there. She notes that she finds that it's absurd to send these things in for analysis when crime labs can't even get through a backlog of rape kits. And she notes that if prosecutors are going to require lab testing, they also risk people sitting in jail for prolonged periods. And the council member, Greg Kassar, he's correct in pointing out that this disproportionately impacts people of color. So interesting to see how this will shake out. One more comment from a listener who's probably prescient on this matter, Lana Hansen. She says, Greg Abbott is going to lose his mind. The governor of Texas and the city of Austin. No love lost between the two lately when it comes to issues over local control and things like that. So it will be interesting to see if and when this lands on the governor's radar there.
Kind of interesting. I'd forgotten about this, but apparently Governor Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and the House Speaker and the Texas Attorney General all sent a letter last year to county attorneys, district and county attorneys, saying that the hemp law doesn't decriminalize and saying, don't use this as an excuse not to prosecute. And there's a little interesting little line in that letter. Again, this is going back more than 6 months. It says, criminal cases may be prosecuted with lab tests or, this is coming from the governor and lieutenant governor, with the tried and true use of circumstantial evidence.
That's what it says.
Appoint some of you have already made clear in this context. So it sounds like that almost sounds like he's advocating perhaps that tried and true use as an option.
Very interesting.
I'd be interested
in seeing the sort of legal grounding that this is privy to.
that would be interesting. But apparently he seems to concede, this letter seems to concede, that it's not just lab tests that will help you determine whether or not this is the stuff of the
Watch this space. I'm sure we'll hear more about that in the future.
Interesting.
Well, you know, we noted earlier that Senator Cory Booker is out of the presidential race. He says his campaign's, quote, reached the point where we need more money to scale up and continue building a campaign that can win money we don't have. Lots of reactions coming in on social media. Here's a tweet from a certain Texan with a unique perspective on his candidacy, Julian Castro. Excuse me. He says, throughout his campaign, Cory ran with a moral clarity and summoned a more thoughtful dialogue. He always worked to unite people, and the 2020 race was made better by his presence. Only 3 weeks to go there until the Iowa caucus.
How about
there with
that?
One Bernie Sanders.
Hard
the
to believe
there,
the race is on. Yeah. Last, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow. Did you hear my voice do that?
This weather, man.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's that pollen. Hey, listen, we're out of time. We're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, providing visitors a glimpse into the past on Museum Day, January 25th and 26th, with 11 museums, including Bishop's Palace, the Naval Museum, and Moody Mansion.
Details at GalvestonMuseumDay.com.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.
You've been listening to the Texas Standard. Texas Standard and KUT Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find a lot more great content and shows like the Texas Standard in the NPR Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.